From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome to this week. We have a special on Williams this week. No, not Andy Williams, or even Robin Williams, bless him. Not John Williams, no Star Wars themes this week, not even a Vanessa or Serena. It's a Williams you might not know so much about. A very fast Williams. We're up to our back wheels in Williams this week on 30 Laps. Mr. Le Carrier wrote Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, but he didn't know about this bloke, or he might have written about him too. How about Racer, Dancer, Soldier, Spy? Let's whisk the cover of darkness off this guy and find out a little bit more. And also that famous Williams, the Frank Williams Formula One team. He sold it himself this week to the Yanks. Let's hunt down that story. And we also slot in the story of the soured relationship between General Motors and their Holden Special Vehicle dealers from a couple of weeks ago. But let's get cracking, shall we? From Formula One magazine, written by Giles Richards, Frank and Claire Williams hand over the reins of the legendary Formula One team. The Williams team will remain in sport under a new ownership. 16 world titles were won between 1980 and 1997. Sir Frank Williams and his daughter Claire are to end their association with the Williams Formula One team. The pair will conclude their roles as team principal and deputy team principal, respectively, after the Italian Grand Prix, which was a couple of weeks ago, marking the end of an era for one of the most successful teams in Formula One. Family run and independent since their formation more than 40 years ago, the team are committed to remaining in Formula One, but will also do so under the auspices of a new owner after the team's recent purchase by US investment company Doralton Capital. The team subsequently announced formation of a new board to head the company. It will consist of Matthew Savage, the chair of Doralton Capital, Darren Fultz, the chief executive officer of Doralton, and James Matthews, the CEO of Eden Rock, an investment advisory firm based in London, who will replace the Williamses in running the team. Who will replace the Williamses in running the actual team is yet to be announced. Williams was formed in 1977 by Williams himself and Patrick Head, and have been fiercely independent ever since. During that time, they've enjoyed remarkable success with 9 constructors' titles and 7 drivers' championships between 1980 and 1997. However, their last win was in 2012, and Williams have just endured the worst 2 seasons in their 43 years in the big game, finishing last in the championship both times. 2 weeks ago, they announced their sale to Doralton for £136 million. With the future of the team now secured, this feels like the appropriate time for us to step away from the sport, Claire Williams said in Monza recently. We are incredibly proud of our track record as well, and the legacy we leave behind. Williams' deputy team principal has handled the day-to-day management of the team at race weekends since she took the role in 2013 and is the only woman in that role in Formula One. We've always been in it for the love of it, the pure pleasure of going motor racing, so this is not a decision we've taken lightly. But after much reflection and as a family, she said, this may be the end of the era for Williams as a family-run team, but it is the beginning of a new era for Williams Racing, and we wish them much success in the future. The British driver, George Russell, now in his second season with the team, was confident in the new owner. For Claire and the Williams family, the team means a huge amount to them, more than it does to anyone else, he said. They would have not sold it to a company if they did not have faith that they have the team's best interests at heart. In 2004, 3 years before Lewis Hamilton joined Formula One, Frank Williams had come close to signing him. Hamilton has always maintained the greatest respect for Sir Frank, who said in 2012 he would snap Hamilton up should he have wanted to drive for his team. The world champion was among many drivers who expressed sadness at the end of the family's involvement in Monza. I'm a big fan of Sir Frank and his incredible contribution to the sport, he said, where he was always so positive to me and he's one of the people I spoke most to. He was one of the most, if not the most, honest person in Formula One. It is at the end of a chapter, but the legacy will continue. I believe they will keep the name at least. I was hopeful at some stage they would come back and be back in front. I remember dreaming of driving the car Nigel Mansell had, but it never turned into a real option for me. And it was then I moved to Mercedes. I wish them all the best in their next endeavours. And that was Frank and Claire Williams hand over the reins to a legendary Formula One team. And it was written by Giles Richards and came from Motorsport Magazine, dated Friday, 4th of September, 2020. Could be best described in their heyday as a runaway. She was indeed. And we run away to our next story. From the same magazine, Motorsport Magazine, racer, dancer, soldier, spy. I've just noticed it's our favourite author, Anonymous. I'll hunt that author's name down for you and give it to you next week. However, he won the first Monaco Grand Prix and he was executed by the Gestapo in 1945 for spying. The Williams story does not need embellishing, so why have we had some people try? And that was won by Bill Cash. So Bill Cash is obviously the author. So there we go. Charles Frederick William Grover was virtually unknown outside historic motor racing circles until very recently. To pre-war racing buffs, he was best known as the mysterious British winner of the 1929 Monaco Grand Prix. Held on April 14, it was the inaugural race around the world's most glamorous street circuit. At the wheel of a green, privately owned Bugatti T35B, Williams, as he liked to style himself, was one of the 16 entrants. He took the lead early, and the 100-lapper developed into an exciting duel. This determined amateur Englishman and the brilliant young Rudy Caracciola, who was working miracles in a monstrous Mercedes SSK. They diced until an unfortunately long pit stop for fuel dropped the German to an eventful third behind Williams and the Bugatti TC35 of Georges Boriano. Williams' victory was no fluke. Between 28 and 33, he won 7 Grand Prix, all of them at the wheel of Bugattis. Admittedly, this tally included a hat-trick, 31-33, in the Grand Prix de la Bolle, a sand race, and a victory over a meagre field in the 1928 French Grand Prix, which was run to sports car regulations. But it also included a win in the 29 French Grand Prix at Le Mans, defeating the Peugeot of a determined André Bouillard, and a memorable success in the 10-hour Belgian GP of 1931, On the latter occasion, shrewd tactics saw his Bugatti T51, co-driven by Count Goberto Cornelli, defeat the Alfa Romeo 8C of Tazio Nuvolari and Belconian Bozzicini, no less. All which makes Williams arguably the most successful, if perhaps not the best known, British racer before World War II. There was an outing in a Bugatti T59 at the 36 Monaco Grand Prix, but Williams had, to all intents and purposes, retired from racing at the end of 1933. With his French wife Yvonne, he moved to a large house in the chic Brittany resort of Le Bal, where he played golf, tennis, and polished his collection of cars. An Yvonne-bred Aberdeen Terriers. It was a leisurely retirement until the war broke out. Williams, a patriotic Englishman, immediately went to London and signed up for the Royal Army Transport Corps. The subject of his exact fate, after being captured by the Gestapo while he was working with the Special Operations Executive, SOE, in Paris, has recently become the subject of a controversial debate. There have been long Lord Lucan-style sightings in the 1960s. Motor racing historian Doug Nye remembers being told that Williams was alive and well and running a greengrocer's in Godalming. But when Nye rang the shop, he discovered the man spoke no French and knew nothing about cars. Still, acting on such racing gossip, journalist Robert Ryan, in conjunction with filmmaker Jack Bond, came up with the idea of writing a fictional, novelised version of Williams' life, entitled Early One Morning. In this, Williams was not executed by the Nazis in Sachsenhausen concentration camp during 1945. In a 7-page Sunday Times magazine cover story published earlier this year, Ryan claimed to unearth new evidence from secret SOE files. There was also a George Smiley-esque interview at the Special Forces Club in Knightsbridge with a legendary intelligence officer for the French section of SOE, Vera Atkins. She claims that, in addition to being a racing driver who became a World War II spy, Williams had a top-secret life beyond the grave. According to Ryan, Williams escaped the concentration camp, was given a new identity, and turned up to an MI6 undercover operative in France after the war, calling himself Georges Tambal. He then moved back in with Yvonne at her house in Urvix. This resurrection theory does have Williams dying at the hands of the Germans, only in 1973 after being knocked off his bicycle in Argonne by a car driven by West German tourists. But this new evidence is flimsy. A neglected letter found in the MI6 archives and dated May 10, 1947, mentioned that operatives had happened upon a chap claiming to be the former Bugatti racing driver, Williams, and that he was asking for help relocating to America. After World War II, lots of people with suspect war records were desperate to reinvent themselves and often fabricated such stories. Williams had been a famous sporting figure, so would have been a natural target for would-be imposters, especially as people would have known that the Nazis, normally meticulous record keepers, very deliberately did not file away their concentration camp execution lists. Bond and Ryan also alluded to the encouraging fact that whereas Robert Benoist's widow had received a war pension, the former Delage and Bugatti racer had been strangled by Nazi piano wire in Buchenwald in 1944, Williams's widow had not received anything. Surely this proves that Williams did not die in 1945. Unfortunately for Bond and Ryan, their theories have been discredited by Williams' brother, Frederick, a former professor in Canada, and by the Bugatti Trust, in whose extensive archives Ryan spent many hours. I can assure you that the kernel of Ryan's argument did not find any evidence to support it here, says Richard Day, curator of the Bugatti Trust. We're certain Williams died in that concentration camp. As far as we're concerned, what has been reported about him surviving is pure fantasy. The Bugatti Trust was founded by respective marque expert Hugh Conway. While compiling his Bugatti papers, Conway visited Yvon in France, where he even met what was Georges Tambal. According to Conway's son, Hugh Jr., the idea that his father could have met Williams without knowing it, to him, was absurd. Moreover, Williams was intensely proud of winning the first Monaco Grand Prix and doted on the impressive silver trophy he had received. Yvon travelled to England to present it to the Bugatti Owners Club in the 1960s. The idea that Williams would have parted with his most prized personal possession 10 years before his own death was described to me by one BOC committee member as one of the most implausible suggestions I have ever heard. The real truth about Williams is more prosaic. According to his old friend René Defoy, another pre-war Bugatti team driver, Williams' clothes and possessions returned to his family after the war in a brown paper parcel. Defoy was luckier and went on to open a famed New York restaurant. One evening there, he bumped into Frederick Williams at the bar. Frederick confirmed to him his brother's fate at the hands of the Nazis. More recently, Bugatti historian John Staveley, who had spent the last 8 years researching a biography of Williams, tracked down Frederick in Canada. He only accepts that Williams died at the hands of the Gestapo. Nobody ever contacted him to inform him otherwise. Even minus this extra chapter, Williams' life was very much boy's own, and not without mystery or intrigue. Exactly who was this man who had a reputation for sitting alone in French cafes, wearing dark glasses and smoking cigarettes, and saying little? Did he have a secret past to hide? Sound of things. Let's read on, shall we? He was born in France in 1903, his mother French, his father English. There's some dispute concerning his father's occupation. According to Frederick, he originally bred horses in Berkshire for a wealthy Russian prince called Trobolevsky, who was the consul at the Russian embassy in London. When Trobolevsky transferred to Paris, Williams' father followed him. And while they somehow fell, I wonder if he was riding one of those Berkshire, anyway, and he somehow fell into the upmarket end of the chauffeuring business, as you do, being what Staveley calls a chauffeur de grand remise, i.e. a luxury car owner, driver for hire. It was a business his son also entered, and it was in this capacity that Williams befriended Bionist, who was working in Bugatti's Paris showroom. Aged just 23, Williams acquired enough capital to buy himself his first racing Bugatti, and his earliest notable result was a second, or third, depending on the source, place in the 26th Grand Prix de Provence at Miramas. One can only assume that he must have been a fairly wealthy man, says Staveley, by what exactly means he made that wealth, I don't know, but would love to know. Possibly Sir William Orpen, his society portrait painting patron, was simply a very generous man. Orpen had been official war artist in World War I. After hostilities had ceased, he settled in a studio in the Hotel Astoria in Paris, where he mainly catered for rich American clients touring Europe. By 1923, the Rolls-Royce that he had to sacrifice to the war effort had been replaced by a new model driven by the young Williams. By the mid-1920s, Williams was also chaperoned Orpin's mistress, Yvonne, Eve, or Brick. The striking blonde daughter of the mayor of Lille, she lived in the house on Rue Weber, which Orpin had given her, having been Sir William's model and muse for a number of years. But the suave Williams was her beau. She loved the adrenaline rush when he drove his cars at speed under railway barriers. They married in November 1929 and were a real high society couple, winning several dance prizes at the grand hotels along the Côte d'Azur. The Art d'Azur, I beg your pardon. During the late 1930s, they owned a villa near the casino in the fashionable resort of Beaulieu-sur-Mer, not far from Monaco. According to William's niece, Jessie, they used to drive around Monaco in separate cars. And although Yvonne would often be stopped for speeding, the police always turned a blind eye to Williams. It is only when World War II begins that accounts of Williams' life diverge. It is known that on joining the army, he was signed up as a driver to a British general who recruited him in 1941 for SOE. Originally codenamed Vladimir, he would eventually operate under the name of Sebastian. It's a pretty good story, this, isn't it, hey? Yes, after intensive training, Williams had parachuted into France on a clear night in 1942. His task was to set up resistance cells, arms supplies and sabotage networks to be codenamed Chestnut in and around Paris. He'd been chosen for this perilous mission because of his influential contacts and abilities to pass himself off as a local. He lived with Yvonne in her house in Paris. According to SOE files, one very successful sabotage hit orchestrated by Williams was at the Citroën Paris factory. But in the main, his efforts to establish Chestnut were hampered by the inability of the British to supply him with a radio operator, and he had almost gone to a rival SOE network called Prosper. When he finally received his radio operator, things began to move forward. Five arms drops were parachuted in by the RAF, and Benoist helped him to smuggle the weapons to his country house in Offagie. But in July 1943, Prosper was betrayed, and Williams and the radio operator were captured. The trail quickly led to Benoist's house, which was where Williams was arrested the following day. Benoist escaped and made it back to England, and he was recaptured in 1944 on his return to France. But Williams was subject to brutal torture at the Gestapo's Paris headquarters. He was then transferred to Sachsenhausen in Germany, where the official records state he was shot March 18, 1945. "He gave nothing away," says Staveley. "He told the Germans nothing. Their own records show that. So he had nobody to be afraid of because he had betrayed no one. In fact, it was Williams who betrayed almost, I'll read that again, it was Williams who was betrayed almost certainly with the knowledge of the British government, who were becoming increasingly worried by the end of the war that the resistance had too many links with communism. The main reason Staveley and other Bugatti historians are quick to dismiss the theories of Williams surviving the concentration camp is the transcripts of interviews with the Sachsenhausen commandant. In his original statement, for fear of being implicated in the Nazi war trials, this senior Nazi official said that Williams had left the camp in January 1945, apparently being moved to Berlin for fuller interrogation. But crucially, he altered his story in 1946. Staveley says, when it became apparent that he would not be sent to Nuremberg, he admitted he had signed Williams's death sentence and personally seen him taken out to his execution. That, sadly, is the truth. The resurrection theories just don't add up. Just ask yourself why Williams would want to go into hiding for all those years. There was nothing he needed to cover up. It made no sense. And the idea that he was sent back to work for MI6 is absurd. SOE and MI6 hated and mistrusted each other. Stavely, like so many others in the Bugatti world, is incensed that Williams' memory is being exploited. He was a war hero, awarded the Croix de Guerre by the French, and a very great racing driver. Surely nothing more need be added. So there we have it, folks. Rosa. I don't think he was a Rosa. Racer, certainly. Racer, dancer, soldier, spy. Written by Bill Cash, and it came from the Motorsport magazine. And what a story that was. So we move now to Go Auto News' John Miller, a story on the 26th of August. General Motors, by withdrawing supply of vehicles, is forcing the closure of HSV, Holden Special Vehicles, in a move that will see HSV dealers losing that business without any compensation at all. In a series of online conferences with dealers last week, HSV was saying that it will no longer be supplied with vehicles for right-hand drive conversion, and therefore there will be no vehicle for HSV to distribute in Australia. Under the terms of the HSV dealer agreement, HSV has the right to terminate its agreements with dealers if GM stops or changes supply of HSV with vehicles. GM has now said it will no longer supply HSV with vehicles to convert, and therefore HSV is exercising that clause in dealer agreements. This allows HSV and by default General Motors to pay the HSV dealers no compensation at all. Under the settlement with dealers for compensation for the loss of the Holden franchise, dealers were paid on the basis of the volume of cars they sold last year. GM is now setting up a completely new GMSV network. The HSV conversion role remains with the Walkinshaw Automotive Group, but the retailing of the vehicles from Walkinshaw passes to GMSV, a wholly owned General Motors company. This arrangement was announced last week. In that meeting, Holden told HSV dealers that GM, which had already stopped supplying Camaro to HSV, would now no longer be supplying HSV with Silverados for HSV dealers to retail. The conversion of the Silverado will continue, but for GMSV. Next year, the Corvette will be added to GMSV, but that will be built, ironically, for a company that says it is out of the right-hand drive business in right-hand drive. This leaves the dealers with the remaining HSV cars to sell, but no brand umbrella from which to sell, and no assistance to clear the aged stock of Camaros that most dealers have. Not a good look, hey, General Motors? And that was from Go Auto News Premium and was written by John Miller. So that's about it from us today. Spies, dancers, racers, Bugattis, Citroens. Wow. Frank Williams and his very capable daughter. We've had it all this week. I've enjoyed your company, as always. And next week, as always, we'll talk about something completely different. Thanks so much for your company. And until next week, bye for now.